Hello, my name is Beth Woodward, and in 2014, I received a Mellon CLEAR grant to fund my dissertation project entitled Le Roman de la Poire, Constructing Courtliness and Courtly Art in Gothic France. This project involved in research at a number of cultural institutions in France and England. I spent a large part of that time in Paris examining medieval manuscripts in person at the Bibliothèque Nationale, but I also conducted research at French municipal libraries and regional museums, as well as at the British Library and at the Bodleian Library in England. The ability to examine objects up close, to view them from different angles, to understand their physical size and texture, and to observe details not visible in photographs fundamentally altered the scope and focus of my project. My dissertation was initially concerned in a somewhat abstract way with examining the concept of courtliness, investigating why and how scholars use the term courtly art and what courtly even means. Gradually, however, the project expanded and focused increasingly on questions of materiality and agency of objects in an unanticipated but highly productive and stimulating way. The primary object in this research is a 13th century manuscript containing the text of an old French poem called Le Roman de la Poire, or The Romance of the Pear. It is a beautiful, unique, and complex manuscript. Some of its illuminations are frequently reproduced in our historical publications as quintessential examples of courtly art of the 13th century, despite the fact that we have no evidence for its association with a specific court, and the very concept of a court is problematic for this time period. Before embarking on my research trip, I had access to some, but not all, of the manuscript's images in books and in online image databases. While staying in Paris, I initially spent a lot of time examining older black and white microfilms before I requested access to original manuscripts. I was fortunately allowed to examine a large number of secular Romance manuscripts from the 13th and 14th centuries, and was even eventually granted permission to view the Roman de la Poire manuscript itself, although for just half a day. Seeing it in person led me to observe details of the image's iconography, painting techniques, the book's facture and materials, and crucially, physical traces of past viewers' interactions with the book's pages and its images. The marks made by past readers prompted me to consider the importance of embodied viewing experiences and the ways that medieval audiences were attuned to the power and agency of artfully crafted physical objects in their lives. An example of such embodied viewing appears here on Folio 5 Verso. A full-page painting depicts the poet and his beloved lady twice in two vertically arranged roundels. In the upper roundel, the lovers sit together on an elaborate bench, and the lady presents a golden ring to the poet as a sign of her loyalty. The roundel below depicts the escalation of the lover's relationship to a more physical stage. Their bodies entwine in an embrace and their faces merge in a kiss. This lower roundel exhibits various signs of damage, including worn or tarnished gold leaf and loss of pigment. The damage is most extensive and visible on the faces of the embracing lovers, perhaps indicating the wear and tear to the image's surface in this area, resulting from deliberate action on the part of a past reader viewer. Whether defaced by an offended reader or smudged by the repeated touch of more enthralled viewers, it is clear that this image elicited an affective response from its audience. This page, with the lovers exchanging first a ring and then a kiss, also touches on another key direction that my project has taken, namely the role of gift exchange in medieval art and culture. This research has led me to conclude the text and images of the illuminated Roman de la Poire and in many related works of courtly art and literature thematize erotic love through the exchange of gifts, which become sites for focusing, intensifying, and crucially redirecting the lover's desire. In other words, these gifts take on the role of erotically charged, fetishized objects. The poet's love for his lady is presented in both text and image as continually deferred and fixated by intermediary objects. The Roman de la Poire, its author says, is a poem composed by a male poet in order to please his beloved lady. The text begins with a prologue and a series of first-person monologues delivered by the poet and other characters, including exemplary lovers from classical and medieval legend. The rest of the poem narrates the protagonist's own love story, starting with the titular pear tree episode, which is also portrayed in a decorated initial shown here. The pear tree episode firmly establishes the importance of intermediary objects in the Poir manuscript, as it is through the mediation of a piece of fruit that the poet and the lady first fall in love. The text and image portraying this episode recount in meticulous detail how the lady peels a pear with her teeth, bites into it, then offers the fruit to the poet, who takes a bite and immediately falls in love. He describes the fruit as a holy object that contains some supernatural force, which is animated by physical contact with the lady's mouth, and that changes the course of his life forever. Elsewhere in the illuminated Poir manuscript, the poet receives a ring from the lady as a token of her love. That's the scene I showed you briefly earlier. At another point in the poem, as he prepares to fight in a tournament against médisants or slanderers, the poet is prompted by the lady to affix items that she gives him, her own headscarf, as well as a cloth pennant, to his body and weaponry as visible signs of her romantic affection. The poet later removes his heart from his body and has it delivered via messenger to the lady, who accepts it into her own body, as we see here on the right. The lady then returns the favor, sending her own heart to the poet to keep in his care. The hearts exchanged by the lovers are not merely metaphors. The text and images in the manuscript confirm that real pieces of flesh, pear-shaped and red-tinted, are removed and transferred, still living, into new bodily receptacles. Arguably, the most fascinating and complex object exchanged between the lovers is the poem itself. In the prologue to the Poir, the poet explains that he is a vassal of Amor, the god of love, and that he composes the poem in order to please his beloved lady. He describes his work as a gift, présent, and a book, livre. It appears as both book and present in a painting that depicts the poet kneeling and presenting a bound codex to his beloved lady. And it appears in book form in the hands of anyone who was lucky enough, like I was, to turn the pages of the illuminated Poir in the manuscript's reading room of the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. In an ironic twist of fate, the entire Roman de la Poir manuscript was digitized in high resolution and made available online precisely during the period I was in Paris attempting to gain access to it in January of 2015. The entire manuscript, including images of its wonderful original 13th century stamped leather binding, is now visible on the BNF's digital library, Gallica, at gallica.bnf.fr. Having ready access to digital images after I returned to Chicago and continued writing the dissertation was, of course, an immense benefit. However, as we all know, nothing compares to examining an object in person. The sensation of turning a manuscript's pages with one's own hands, smelling the scent of old parchment, and understanding the physical reality of a material object. This is a haptic experience that simply cannot be replicated in a virtual format. I became interested in thinking about the problems and opportunities presented by online image collections and digital humanities projects while I was in graduate school, especially since I was combing through databases of digitized manuscripts and perusing museum collections online. But it became a more significant focus of mine once I moved from Chicago, with all its museums and libraries and universities, to a small town in southern Maine in order to teach at Bates College. I initially incorporated digital images and three-dimensional renderings of architecture and art objects into my classes as a way to supplement and expand students' comprehension of faraway places and objects, all from the comfort of our Maine-based classroom. Once the pandemic struck in early 2020 and we transitioned to online and hybrid formats, such digital resources have taken on an even more prominent role in my teaching. For their part, museums, libraries, and other cultural institutions have ramped up their efforts to make their collections remotely accessible, and new and exciting image-based digital humanities projects are continuously being created. In my courses, students are asked to use online databases to find images for their research projects, and I have students make virtual visits to museums, churches, mosques, and other sites around the world in order to gain a more robust understanding of, for example, an exhibition's arrangement, a building's layout, or an object's physical dimensions or reconstructed original appearance. Students have even used digital tools to create their own hypothetical virtual museum exhibitions and are prompted to think about how their imaginary museum might incorporate real digital resources. A sampling of the many online resources that I've used just this past academic year includes the wonderful Mapping Gothic France, which is about the next best thing to actually visiting a Gothic church in person. And I've sent students to examine the fascinating and enigmatic grave goods of the Oseberg ship burial in the Viking Ship Museum in Oslo, Norway. Students have also explored topics on Islamic art, like the role of water and sound in Islamic architecture, thanks to the videos available on ComScene Islamic Art History Online. And students have virtually toured the Sistine Chapel and Raphael's stanza in the Vatican in order to better understand the size, physical setting, and coloristic effects of these famous paintings. One interesting problem that the use of such digital resources has inadvertently raised, or more likely is intersecting with already existing issues of digital literacy among traditionally college-age students today, is that they can give students a false sense of the availability and accessibility of information. I thus see it as imperative to emphasize to students that only the tiniest portion of the world's historical objects, images, and texts have been digitized, and this work has only just begun. Furthermore, the act of digitization itself is fundamentally tied to larger economic, political, national, and cultural ideologies. What gets digitized and why? How are digital materials described and cataloged? Who makes such decisions, and what agendas, unacknowledged privileges, and systems of belief might be at work in making those decisions? As digital sources become increasingly available, it is even more important that researchers and teachers keep asking those questions and encouraging our students to think critically about such questions too. Thank you.